Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, and today we have a very interesting show for you. We have a visitor from the UK, and he is going to be talking about someone who those of you in the pastry world for sure will know. We're talking about Antonin Carême from the early 19th century, and here with us to talk about it is a master pastry chef himself, Eric Landlord. Eric is a master pâtissier from London, and he has written several different books. His newest one is called Tarted Up. He has a shop called Cake Boy and a book by the same name, as well as books on cookies and cakes and all kinds of things. And as well, Eric is a bit of a TV star. Is that right?
Hello, yes. Well, we've got a few, we've done four TV series back in the UK, you know, about the baking craze. It's something, you know, in the last few years just started in the UK, and suddenly baking become very popular, which is great because...
not great for our waistlines, but it's great.
Not for the waistline, but, you know, we've been... I've been fighting for that for ages, and people used to laugh at me and saying, "Baking? Nobody want to bake. Nobody want to make dessert." And suddenly, you know, if you visit the UK, you will see them on all the TV network, every single foodie magazine for the last 2 years, and I've been having a cake on a cover. Things you would have never thought would have happened before. So I do have the last laugh.
Well, indeed, I mean, everyone loves a good cake, but your cakes are more than just what we would make at home. I mean, you, yes, indeed, you do cakes for what we make at home, but you are a master pâtissier and a celebrity chef to the stars and the royalty. I mean, you have baked cakes for the huge big names, Elton John, the Beckhams. Can you name a couple others?
Yes, I mean, we've been very lucky to have you know, some celebrity clients. They do help to with the business. Elizabeth Hurley, Claudia Schiffer as well, who always make put a smile on people's face and say, "Elizabeth Hurley, eat cakes. Claudia Schiffer, eat cakes."
Right.
But actually, they do, and they love their food, and they know what we're talking about. So, which is always a great pleasure to work with. But the thing I like to remember people all the time is that, you know, yes, we do cake for celebrities, but we do cake, you know, for everybody as well.
Well, and your books are a testimony to that, because the books are very approachable. The recipes are all very approachable, home desserts.
Well, that's what I always say to people. There's two sides of Eric. There is Eric at work, obviously the trained pastry chef, doing some beautiful pâtisseries and you know, elaborate wedding and celebration cakes. But there is Eric at home as well. And Eric never take a dessert from the shop if he entertain. So
Oh, really?
It doesn't matter how busy I am or anything, I will never take something from the counter and take it to, you know, serve it to my friends at home. I will always make something. That's a strict rule I got, because for me it's like cheating. And then people who've never been for dinner at my house always expect to get like Michelin style dessert, and they're a bit surprised when actually they're going to get a tarte tatin piping hot, straight from the oven. I'm going to turn it at a table with the steam and the juice oozing out, because that's my kind of baking at home. And that's the kind of thing I try to do with the books, is, you know, to make it accessible to people. And to, you know, people have been scared about baking. They think they need a lot of equipment or very, you know, special ingredients. But, you know, you can... Everybody can do it. You don't have to be a scientist, you know, to do some great baking. And it's so rewarding as well.
Mm. Well, now, I mentioned that you are a bit of a television, not a bit, you are quite a television star in the world of baking and TV food shows, with a couple different series. And in case someone didn't notice by listening to you with your accent, you are French living in the UK, and you had a very important French influence in your baking as well. I mentioned Antonin Carême. For those who don't know, tell us a little bit. You became enamored by his success and his path, and you did some research on Carême, because you did a whole series of your food shows on called Glamour Puds, and it was about the history of Antonin Carême, correct?
Yes, of course. I trained. I obviously trained in France, in Brittany, you know, back where I grew up. And Antonin Carême was obviously mentioned when I studied. He was known as the godfather of pâtisserie, probably the first celebrity chef. So, but unfortunately, you know, they give you just a little hint about how important he was. You mm-hmm. knew he was important in the industry, but not as much as. As much as we discovered. And it was, I had the opportunity, who came to me to buy his original books. He was one of the first chef to write recipe books and, beautiful books, actually. So I bought these two books and I got starting to get obsessed with it. So when we had the opportunity to do a TV show, I said, like, why don't we follow his footsteps, which we did. I mean, looking back at him, you know, his nickname is, you know, the chef of the king and the king of the chefs,
right?
Because he was really the first celebrity chefs. He was, you know, everybody was fighting for him, from, you know, from Napoleon to the Prince Regent in England, to, you know, the Tsar of Russia wanted him.
And he cooked for them all.
He cooked for them all, but at the same time, he's responsible for so many things. I mean, he's the one who put chefs in chef's whites. He's the one
That's
who
right.
put discipline in a kitchen.
And he was also credited with creating the toque, the chef's toque.
The chef's hat, yeah. He created that because, you know, he wanted chefs to be, you know, respected, because chefs before were not respected. You know, most of them were illiterate. And it's an amazing story. And as we filmed, as we went along, and mostly on location, we were so lucky to go to so many beautiful places. And we went to the to St. Petersburg, where he cooked for the Tsar. Actually, he never cooked for him because he wasn't there, but he he went there, you know, almost killing himself on a journey there. We went on all these beautiful locations, and as we were going along, we realized how much a parallel world it was between him and myself.
Oh,
and it was all a bit spooky, actually. We because I mean, I knew a bit about him, not as much as we learned as we went along, but yeah, it was really an amazing journey to do for myself as well, to discover how hard it was and the condition those guys were working in a kitchen. I mean, if you were a chef in those days,
now
the
we're talking about the early 1800s.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So you were your life expectation would be under 30. You will, by the age of 26, 28, you would be dead, because everybody was cooking on coal, and it was no extraction in the kitchen. They're usually in basement, and they're all dying of lung cancer. And that's what happened to Carême, unfortunately.
Yeah, he died early. What was about? He was about 50 years old?
Or? It wasn't even 40, I think.
Oh,
he just
48.
40
and
years.
He was not
something.
Quite, yeah.
Yeah. And he was the lucky one, because he was looked after at the end of his year by some of his you know, fans. And it was quite funny. One of the things we did is by the end of his career, he had a whole selection of ladies, fans, who were paying extreme amount of money for him to cook and bake for them. And we found out, and actually it's quite the same with me back in London. So we asked one of my fans, Lady Judge, to host a dinner party, and we recreated at the Royal Academy, where the Prince Regent used to live, a proper banquet with all the pièces montées where Carême was famous for.
Now, explain to our listeners what a pièce montée is that he was so famous for.
Well, pièce montée is an edible creation, sculpture. It could be anything from, mostly Carême's one was like almost like temples and building, who will sit on the middle of the table and people could nibbles as they went along.
So sugar creations of architectural masterpieces.
Yes.
And they became masterpieces. And the sugar became masterpieces.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And they're covered with like a little shoe, little macaroons or little treat when people can just pick. And it was interesting. So I had to do that. I designed that banquet table and we had an historian who was there. And at the end of the dinner, you know, I walked in and, you know, we created a full-on menu from Carême. And the historian said, you know, you are Carême. Because he said, you made exactly the same mistake of Carême. You're not an architect, so you don't understand, you know, your Greek or your Venetian column or your pagoda, Japanese pagoda. So you mixed up all the different styles. And that's what Carême used to do.
Oh,
if you look at his book, nothing matched really. The column at the wrong column for the roof of the building or something. And I did exactly the same thing without knowing, because obviously I'm not a trained architect, but I went for, you know, the artistic side of it.
Mm.
And it was interesting when that historian said that. He said, you know what, you and Carême, you know, you are like separated at birth, because he said you made exactly the same mistake than he did.
Hmm. Now, a little background on Carême, too, which I think differs from you, hopefully. he was basically abandoned as a child, right? He was an orphan and was illiterate and went to work basically almost like a slave job in a bread bakery, right?
Yeah, that's what's happened. He came from a large family just at the end of the revolution, and they could not feed him. So his father took him in the street of Paris, and his last word to his son was, va mon petit, où le Dieu t'emporte, meaning, you know, go my son, where God take you. And he got picked up by a baker, and he spent, you know, a few months just raising yeast and sifting flours. But his passion for baking, he had two passions. One was baking and being an architect, and he could not become an architect because obviously he could not read, he could not write. So mm-hmm. he went, every time he had a day off, time off, he went to the Bibliothèque Nationale, the National Library in Paris, and he teach himself how to design buildings and how to learn to read and write as well.
Interesting, yeah. And his passion for baking, I mean, he taught himself not only to bake, I mean, he was the master of meringues. He really set the standard for so many things that are still used today, right?
He did. I mean, most of everything, all the basic we know, from puff pastries to choux pastries to meringue, which is well famous for, is thanks to him. And looking back, it's just unbelievable. I mean, the same with, you know, he created at the end of his life the piping bag, because they didn't have any piping bag in the past. But the most important thing that came out from...
the pastry bag, piping bag being a pastry bag that you can create designs in small, you know, small holes with.
But the most important thing for me who came out of that, it was really the quality of life that the chefs have in those days and how difficult it was. You know, they have no fridges, they have, they didn't have any ovens, or, you know, it wasn't like today. So when I hear young chef complaining or having a moan because, you know, it's too hot in the kitchen or this or that, I can tell you, you know, I'd never moan ever. I mean, I'm not a moaner anyway, but it was just unbelievable the condition they were working for. You know, they have to grate their own sugar, they have to, you know, try to make ice cream, because of course the demand from the rich people they're working for was crazy. You know, mm-hmm. they were going like, I want some ice cream piled up on the middle of the table when freezers and fridge didn't exist. So looking back at today, you know, it's really amazing what they used to produce in those days.
All right. Well, now, aside from just pastries, Carême was a cook, a chef as well. I mean, he cooked everything, for particularly when he went to Russia. Is that correct? Did he not do all the cooking?
Yes, he did. Later on in life, he started to get involved in savory cooking as well. I mean, he invented the third course. When he went to Russia, before you went to Russia, service à la française was where you serve on big platters. All the food was on display in buffet, or it would be served on big platter.
So everything was out at once.
It was out at once. And when you went to Russia, suddenly it was service à la russe, where everything is served on the plate. Like you see today in most top restaurants, the food arrived plated, beautifully presented. So when he came back...
In different courses.
Right. So he bring that back to the to Paris when he came back from his trip to Russia. He did that, and he did the same with the dessert. Forget about the pièce montée you ate on the middle of the table. He put the dessert on the plate, and he invented the third course. He invented the dessert.
Interesting. Wonderful. So glad he did. That's a great wrap-up to the meal.
I know. We're glad too.
Yeah. Well, we're going to hear more about your wonderful sweet endings, too, when we come back after a short break.
By Controller on heritageradionetwork.org.
No religion, I see no light. No religion, I see no light. My last thoughts as they come to me are only pictures of you. The pain's not dying, it's knowing I will never again see.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Washed rind cheeses are a fairly recent addition to the repertoires of artisanal cheesemakers in the United States. These cheeses tend to be stinkier than other types and are often high on the list of connoisseurs. Now, Whole Foods Market has come up with one of their own. The raw cow's milk cheese made by Sprout Creek Farm in Poughkeepsie, New York, is washed with 6-point ale from Red Hook, Brooklyn. The beige sticky rind deepens in color as it ages. The satiny ivory cheese within is mellow, with a sweetly tangy bite and a grassy aroma. The current version features 6-point diesel, which is in limited supply, so stop by and pick up some before it's gone. And point-of-origin cheese is sold exclusively at Whole Foods Market in New York, northern New Jersey, and Connecticut. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
We are back on A Taste of the Past, and I'm talking with Eric Landlord, a pastry chef, a master pastry chef to the stars and to the royalty, both pop royalty, they say, and real royalty. Who's the real royalty that you've baked cakes for or other things?
Well, one of our biggest fan in a UK royal family was the Queen Mother.
Ah.
Who was, like we say in France, a bon viveur, you know. She was still living in the old style, you know, when she was accoutumed to. And she was a great fan of our cooking. I mean, she knew about food. And the Queen as well is the same. You know, she's very foodies. You know, you have to imagine, you know, they got the best chefs working for them. But the Queen Mother was always a great fan. She loved chocolate and raspberries. So she was great, and I met her on her 101st birthday, which was really phenomenal. It wasn't planned, and suddenly out of the blue, she came in, and when we delivered one of the cake for her, and she was lovely and very pleasant, and we always got some beautiful letters from the palace or from her sign. And this year for the Jubilee as well, we got asked to create a cake for Her Majesty the Queen for the Jubilee, a Jubilee cake. So we created the recipe, and the palace said, "Oh, can you bake one for the Queen, and we will serve it to her for afternoon tea." So, and again, we got this beautiful letter, and you can imagine when the letter turned up with a stamp, Buckingham Palace, you get excited about it. And but it was always handwritten, beautiful letters with a lovely card and saying thank you and how much they enjoyed and lovely details. But I was talking to a chef at the time, and he was saying the Queen today, it doesn't matter if it's six people for dinner, intimate dinner, or if it's 3,000 people for a huge banquet at Buckingham Palace. She's the one who put the final signature on the menu. She's getting involved of matching the wine and the food, and she absolutely loves and passionate about food.
Oh, that's excellent.
And yeah. It's all done still in the old traditional way of the Court of Europe, where all the menus are in French and a subtitle in English.
Interesting.
So it's all done like it was done in Russia in the old days, or it was done in Germany, or all over Europe in those days, where, you know, French was the culinary language.
So Antonin Carême would have felt right at home cooking today for the palace. Right?
Absolutely. I'm sure he would have loved some of his recipe and creation. And that's what the Prince Regent did in the UK. You know, he beat Napoleon at the war, but I think the biggest humiliation he could do, after throwing a lot of money, he got Napoleon's chef. And I think was even bigger,
yeah, that's right,
victory compared to a military victory to get Napoleon's chef to cook for him.
Huh,
but Carême didn't stay long. He didn't like him because he said he was a bit of he had no idea about food and he absolutely hated it. And after 6 months, he packed his bag and went back to France.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Well, and it was Talleyrand who actually was one of the first who kind of lasso Carême and introduce him to all these famous people he eventually cooked for. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was. Napoleon wanted to do some diplomacies, so he bought a castle down in the Loire Valley, and Napoleon absolutely hated it, eating in public, and hated entertaining. So he told Talleyrand, I said, okay, you take that castle and you have to entertain. And it took Carême with him, and it was Carême had to create some different menus every day. They have to entertain all the biggest decision, and I think it's still the same today. Most of all, the biggest political decision didn't happen in the offices. It really happened over lunch or over dinner, and I'm sure it's the same today. I'm sure politicians do meet in public or something, but it all happened when they sit down through good food, and that's how it used to happen.
That's
and Talleyrand
right.
was the one who created and put them together.
Well, now you were talking about how you recreated all of Carême's pièces de montée, and I actually watched you doing a mini version of Napoleon's, I think it was Napoleon's cake, or maybe Napoleon's son's cake, or somebody's cake on television, on one of your television series, with the meringue swans and the chestnut cream, and it was a Mont Blanc, right?
That's it, yeah, Gâteau Mont Blanc, yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, in your books, as I said, they are more approachable. They're not necessarily recreations of these elaborate, labor-intensive desserts. But you do have, in your recent book, Tarted Up, you have both savory and sweet tarts in there, quiches but yet sweet tarts as well, right?
Exactly. And I wanted to do that for a little while because, yes, baking is back in fashion and in the UK, and I'm sure it's the same here in the US, and it's fantastic. But savory baking, I was a bit like the underdog of baking. People always think, stodgy pie.
Pies and casseroles, right?
Quiche, you can buy from the supermarket, with soggy pastries and everything like that. So I wanted to, put it back in fashion. I wanted to show to people in that book that actually it's not just for winter, because people always assume savory baking is for winter. So you can cook all year round and we make some beautiful savory tart. And at the same time, still of them looking great, because I know it's nice to bake something and to put it at a table and get the wow factor, but if you look at the pictures in that book, you would be proud to put that savory tart or that pie on the table, and you will get a wow factor because you can make them to look glamorous and fabulous.
Oh, they absolutely don't. You know what I also loved about this, your newest book in particular, is that there are several photographs of the work in progress, step by step, which I think is so important, because some people they see the beauty shot, if you will, final beautiful pie sitting there, or the cake sitting there, but they don't know necessarily how the dough is supposed to look or how the batter should look. And you have these photographs split up, and it's very helpful, I think, to the home baker.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's something I'm very, proud of. And we're very lucky with our publishers. You know, they spend a lot of money on the pictures and the step-by-step, you know, that's one of the comments we get the most, because it's nothing worse than having a recipe, you know, without first the final pictures, but it's great to be able to see the different step, and you go like, oh, okay, I didn't do anything wrong. That's what it's supposed to look like.
That's right.
The pastry is supposed to look like that. Oh, that's how you line a tart base. And at the same time, I like giving more tips. You know, I love bringing flavors. So, you know, if you're going to make a short crust pastry, okay, don't just make a short crust pastry. You can add some fresh herbs to it. You can, you know, put some zest of lemon or orange. And, you know, you can jazz it up as well, just to boost and make it, you know, the final produce much more exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, your television series are all very educational. I mean, you obviously have fun with what you do, because it shows, it comes across on the screen. And what I like, too, though, is that it's also kind of no-nonsense. You're having fun with it, but yet the instructions are all very clear. You can really learn from watching you cook on television, I have to tell you. And I'm very impressed with that.
Well, I'm glad you say that, because that's really the whole idea behind it. You know, for far too long, I've been listening to people who've been saying, you know, oh, baking is too difficult. I haven't got the time. I haven't got the equipment. I can't get the ingredients. And I go on TV and I say to people, listen, you can do it. I mean, obviously, we're not cooking. It's not making a stew. So you need to follow the recipe. Like we say in France, you know, baking is like chemistry.
That's
but
right.
If you are following the recipes, and in my book, on the same in a TV show, I always make sure then everything, you can get it in a supermarket, or even better, it is in everybody's kitchen cupboard. So I'm not going to start to use some ingredients and people can't get, or they have to go online. You know, I want to make it accessible. I want people to understand they can do it. And it's great. That's the main feedback we get. People said, I watch your show. The next thing I did is I put my apron on and I made a cake. And that's so rewarding for me. I really enjoy that.
Now, what is the name of the series that's playing currently on British television?
It's called Baking Mad with Eric.
Baking Mad with Eric.
Baking Mad with Eric.
What is it, Channel 4 television?
It's on Channel 4 as well. And you can get it on YouTube as well. There's different clips, including some very foreign version of it with some very bad subtitle.
Oh.
The Italian one is my favorite one. The voiceover, it's someone like who sounds like 85 or something. You know, it doesn't match me at all.
It was on YouTube where I discovered the Glamour Puds, meaning Glamour Puddings, right?
Yes.
Where you did the history, and you actually, as you said, you did a walking tour, 10 episodes, going to on location to different places that had part of the history of Antonin Carême, and I was so pleased to have been able to watch that and learn a little bit more, having read history of him, but to see it come to life on your show was truly a treat. And I love cooking from your books as well and from your television shows.
Thank you.
And I thank you so much for joining me today. It has been a true pleasure. Eric Landlord, and his new book is called Tart It Up. This has been A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.